forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works do.
Hello, it's Thursday, May 19th, and this is a special episode of the Works Do podcast. I'm Kate Gase Walton. I'm the editor of WorksDo.com, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. The next regular episode, episode number 9, will be released on May 30th. But today I spoke with Bob Richards, a veteran air traffic controller who worked for more than 20 years in the towers at O'Hare. Since the job of air traffic controller has been much in the news lately, I wanted to get my conversation with Bob out sooner rather than later. Here's the interview. I am talking today to Bob Richards, who is a retired air traffic controller with about 25 years of experience. Is that right, Bob?
25 years total, 22 of them at Chicago O'Hare, the world's busiest airport in the universe.
And you are, as far as I can tell, one of the world's busiest men at the moment, with air traffic control being so much in the news. So first, Bob, I just want to thank you for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it.
You bet. I look forward to it.
Now, you mentioned just when we first got on the line an incident at O'Hare. That's actually not something I'm even aware of. So let's start there. What has happened and what's your view on it?
Well, it's so recently happened that I don't even have all the details of it yet. And basically, it involves the fact that within about 8 minutes after Airport 2 carrying Joe Biden landed, that there was an incident that occurred pretty much along the same runway that Joe Biden landed. But as to all the details of it, they're just finding that out right now. But it sounds to me like it was just one of those situations where an aircraft had to go around, and when they go around, sometimes they get a little close. And that's usually the out when things get a little close. So, but beyond that, it's all speculation as far as right now. It's just pretty much ongoing right now as we speak.
Okay, well then, in that case, let's back away from the specific incident to what I first wanted to talk to you about, which is very much kind of the broader picture. So, as you know, I started Works Do because I believe that a lot of people make career decisions, you know, a really important decision in someone's life, based on actually usually very little understanding of the full range of jobs that are out there and what they might entail. And I think that people also weigh in on policies and issues that affect people's jobs without necessarily understanding those jobs very well. And we've certainly seen a lot of people weighing in on the job of air traffic controller in recent weeks. So what I wanted to do was bring in someone who has done that job for many, many years and have them talk to what is involved in the job and also some of these current issues. So can you just start first by telling us, how does someone become an air traffic controller? For example, you know, why did you become an air traffic controller, and what kind of training was required?
Well, it's obviously changed since I started out, but initially when I started out, I kind of got into the military. And by getting in the military, of course, you get trained as an air traffic controller, and then once you're out of the military, it makes it an easy transition for the federal government to hire you. Also, in those days, it was basically done on a federal test. If you passed the exam at a certain score, then you would get to go to Oklahoma City, which is in Oklahoma City, for a 16-week course. And if you passed that course, you were sent on to an airport. And basically divided into three different areas, which is, one is the tower, where you work the tower at the airport, which is basically up to 5,000 feet and 5 miles from the airport. Or you could be working in a TRACON, which is a radar room approach control, which basically entails 5,000 to about 24,000 and then about 40 miles out from the airport. Or you could be working at the center function, which is high altitude, and that's usually anything above 24,000. Those are the three air traffic functions that you could do. In today's world, because there's such a need for air traffic controllers because of the massive retirements that have occurred recently, they've kind of run out of that real quickly. The military controllers are depleted. There's not many to choose from. The federal exam they've used, but now they've gotten to the point where they have 10 different, at least 10 colleges that I know of across this country that actually teach the air traffic control course and prepare people for that federal exam as well as the job itself. So you can, that seems to be the way to go right now, is through this college program. They still take people off the street if they pass the exam, and they still take military people. So that's the three best ways.
Got it. So are all air traffic controllers employed by the FAA? Is that correct? There's no such thing as a private air traffic controller?
There is private contract towers, and that's kind of been the swing in the last 5 years, the trend that is to go towards saving money by staffing these smaller airports with in towers where there's basically contracted out, and they're not federal air traffic controllers, they're contracted out. And they tend to get instruction from some federal people, but most of the time they're just contracted out. Ex-controllers, ex-military controllers, ex-Department of Defense controllers, and they make a lot less money. They tend to staff the facilities a lot less than they would a normal FAA facility, because it becomes involved about a money-making thing, which is kind of a thing that there's been a big argument between, you know, controllers and management about that situation occurring that way, and it's been proven that it's been kind of a disaster in some cases, because there has been some terrible incidents that have occurred because one person was in the tower when there was normally three people in the tower when it was federally staffed. But for the most part, a good portion of the towers are still run by the FAA and the government, and there's a certain select group now that are trending towards becoming contract towers to save money.
I see. And all the FAA air traffic controllers, which sounds like it's still the vast majority, are they all unionized?
15,700 controllers currently, and I don't know the number, but I would say a good portion of them, probably 80% plus, are unionized, yeah, or a member of the union, that is.
Okay. But and then just to get, you know, kind of the basics on the job, what is, in today's world, kind of the pay range for an air traffic controller? What would you see from, say, a very inexperienced person to a very experienced person?
Well, that's been changing too. Now, the old pay range, again, and in both, there's basically two pay scales. One for the people that were in prior to Marion Blakey, who changed the pay structure a few years ago. But basically, pay is dictated by the amount of airplanes you work at any particular airport. So clearly, if you work at a small airport like Springfield, Illinois, where they have a few commuter airplanes in and out, versus O'Hare, the variance may be anywhere from starting from 30,000, 40,000 to as much as 120,000 to 130,000, depending upon which airport you end up at. But certainly you get paid by the number of airplanes you're going to be working in and the busier airports and stuff. So right now, you know, Chicago, LA, Atlanta, New York airports, I mean, those are the places you're going to get the highest pay. You'll be at the top of your scale. And also at those airports, a lot of overtime, a lot of short staffing in a lot of places. That obviously is going to increase your pay per year. But to be quite honest with you, I don't know of anybody that gets into air traffic control because of the money. Most people I know get into traffic control because they love working airplanes. And even if they want to get to a place like O'Hare, most people aspire to get to a busier place so they can work more airplanes. Very rarely do you find somebody who gets into it for the money, because if you're in it for that reason, you're not going to have a good time.
Right. I want to go now to a question that came in from one of WorkStu's readers. Her name is Lori Christ, and she wrote in saying, my image of an air traffic controller comes from movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and books like Airport. In the book Airport, the job of controller caused life-threatening stress. Would you say that's still true?
I would say the busier the airport, the more stress, the more likelihood that you have medical problems. And I've talked about that in my book, Secrets from the Tower, at length, particularly in the appendix in The Last Flight Home, where I basically memorialize six of my friends that were controllers. And, you know, four of them died a sudden cardiac death. I mean, no previous symptoms. They just dropped over. Poop had pancreatic cancer, and you say, well, you know, it's possible that people's jobs, people die. But these people were 29, 30, 38, 39, 43, and 49 years old. And so that is not a normal happening. I mean, that if that doesn't say something about stress being underrated, I don't know what else can.
And what about your experience? It sounds like it was a job that you really loved doing, but, you know, what was your sense of the stress levels?
My sense of the stress levels is like anybody else. When you're in your 20s and your 30s, you're a young kid, you feel invincible, like you can do anything, because you have that strength and you have that energy level. And then when you get into your 40s and you get a little bit more experience and you start seeing a cardiologist, you start wondering, well, maybe I could have done things a little bit different. So, yeah, while many people have died, a lot of people have been pretty much have medical conditions, whether it's ulcers, whether it's atrial fibrillation, like I've had. Now I've had atrial fibrillation. Now, upon retirement, I've got outfitted with a defibrillator and have become a CHF patient. So I certainly wasn't spared by any means, but nor have a lot of other people. So stress is something that, while you don't have a lot of studies on it and it doesn't really get evaluated, I can pretty much see, I've seen it firsthand. I don't need anybody to tell me what stress does to somebody. I've seen it in extreme proportions.
Right. Lori had another question, which was that, you know, again, us outsiders looking in, we get an understanding of what you've done from movies and books. And she says, in movies, the radar screens the controllers stare at appear incredibly confusing. How has the changing technology improved the job of the controller? Has it made it easier? How did you see technology change over your time in the tower?
Well, the technology of radar hasn't really changed that much. The presentations that exist today, like in O'Hare Tower, are the same presentations you see 30 years ago. The difference is it's become digitalized. And what that simply means is now, where we used to look at, you know, different distances between aircraft in terms of dash lines, like each dash line might have been a mile, and we were putting 3 miles behind, you know, aircraft that were lined up for a runway, you know, and that nice little stepladder that you see at night going into the major airports. Well, we did 3 miles by visualizing it, by looking at the radar. Now, you have to go beyond that, because now the computer sets in here and it can measure down to the 10th to the 100th of a mile. So even though our guidelines say that 3.0 is acceptable, current guidelines say 2.9 isn't. So what happens is, in the old days when it was wavering between 3 and a little bit below and a little bit above, nobody said anything. But now with the computers and digitalized, it already come on and say, ding, 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 you're at 2.98, this is not good. And so causing a conflict of some kind, which in truth is not a safety issue, but it's an issue of separation. So what controllers then have to do is they have to build in that they don't want to be near that 2.9 like they used to be with no problem. So they'll start at 4, some will start at 5, and when the weather hits, they'll probably go up to 6, 7, and 8, just so they don't get anywhere near where the computer is going to come up as saying 2.9 is not good, 3.0 is okay. So that's the only thing that's really changed in terms of the technology. We still keep track of airplanes with paper strips, something we did 30 years ago. We're still doing it today. We tried touch screens. It wasn't fast enough for people working at O'Hare. Now, that might work somewhere else in a smaller airport, but at O'Hare, where everything is at the speed of light and you're just nonstop talking, it's been shown easier just to move strips around with your hands than it is to touch a screen. So technology, in that sense, hasn't changed so much. There's a ground radar, which is brand new. That's kind of helped in terms of runway incursions, where aircraft inadvertently, you know, get onto an active runway, and the computer will go off and sight that and warn controllers that there's a problem. But outside of that, technology has pretty much stayed the same. There hasn't really been that much change.
Interesting. Now I want to go to a question that was submitted by Jeff Wanker. I think he submitted it somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it touches on a lot of the issues that have been in the news lately, and I'd like to give you a chance to address those. So
sure.
He writes, Did you ever nap on the job? How much coffee did you consume? Where do you stand on the eternal question, Rockstar or Red Bull? Are harder drugs available? Do you like movies with gladiators? And how many times a week did you say, looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue? So,
wow.
A loaded question for Dan.
Here's the best way to say that. I will tell you this. Being an air traffic controller here now, and I can only speak from O'Hare. Now, what the person does in Madison or Terre Haute, Indiana, it's a little bit different, in fact, a lot different in terms of what someone might do at Chicago O'Hare, where you just talk, talk, talk. Every day at Chicago O'Hare, 5-6 hours a day, you are working on pure adrenaline. And you're doing that pure adrenaline, not just 5-6 hours a day. You're doing it 5 to 6 days a week. Multiply that times 22 years, and you can see where how that fits in with your lifestyle. And as far as the coffee aspect of it, I got to tell you something. 1 hour at O'Hare, where I'm talking like a person on the floor of the stock exchange, continuously, boom, 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 United do this, America do this, United do this, and on you go. By the time that hour is up, you feel like you just drank 3 cups of coffee. You are literally on a high right there. And getting down to that break room, and this has always amazed me where people come along and say, well, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to sleep at the job. Well, I'll tell you something. First thing a controller does a lot of times in those situations, particularly as you get towards the end of the work week, is when they get that off that hour and they go down and take their break, there's 5 couches there in the break room. They'll hit that couch, and their eyes may close. So if their eyes close, what is that? Is that transcendental meditation? Is it yoga? What is it? I don't know. So we can get politically correct about all that. But the bottom line is controllers have been using strategies to get themselves back together to get back up for that next hour. And one of them is resting. You have to do it. It's there's no question about what you need to do. It's almost common sense, and it's been going on for 30 years.
Yeah. So I, you know, the FAA administrator, it's Randy Babbitt, correct? And Transportation
right.
Secretary Ray LaHood, they've weighed in with this policy of there will be no napping on any shift. So it sounds to me like that's something that you disagree with.
Well, it's a fantasy. It's not a reality. I'm talking about what you do on your break is what you do on your break. I mean, I don't think if anybody takes a break at their job, people are, you know, standing over them telling them what they can do on their break. That just doesn't happen. And so, you know, some people go work out on their break. Some people go to the exercise room. I mean, it all varies. People have a different way of dealing with stress and fatigue than, you know, that works for them. And who's to tell them, if it's working, that you need to change it? And certainly over a period of the last 30 years, we've been doing this. So, I mean, what are you going to do when somebody's burned out working upstairs? Are you going to, when they go on break, stand over them and say, okay, now stand up, don't lay down, and drink Red Bull, and you'll be fine? I mean, that's not realistic. It's a fantasy.
Right. So when you think about the stress levels and the fatigue, you know, what are the fixes that you think would be sensible? What would you advocate?
Well, I mean, they've done a few things. Probably the best thing they did is they put 2 people in the control tower instead of 1 on the midnight shifts at the busier airports, the busy controlled airports. That was major. And it wasn't major simply because of the fact that, you know, one person could look over to the other person and say, hey, are you awake? What's going on? You know, the reason you put 2 people in the tower is if there's an emergency, and let's say an aircraft is having trouble, if before when you had just 1 person in the tower, you'd be asking that 1 person to talk to the aircraft, find out what's going on, get all the information involved, and then on top of that, that person would also have to find the phone, pick it up, call the city, get up the fired equipment, coordinate with the city, coordinate with the other air traffic facilities, and you'd really be setting up a bad situation for that emergency to be handled properly. And FAA has rolled the dice on that for years, and nothing's happened. But I guarantee you, sooner or later, one day, it would happen when one controller would have to make a call on some emergency, and then it would come to light, and everybody would say, oh, well, how come we didn't have 2 people up there? Well, now we have 2 people up there because not only did it happen once looking at the Washington National incident where it was right over the White House, the guy fell asleep, but then the Reno thing kind of cinched the thing where it said, well, okay, yeah, we'll go to 2 people now. You know, it took that much that many problems for this to happen. But
so that was one change, one recent change. And then I gather that another change was adding an extra hour between work shifts. How effective is that?
Yeah, adding an extra hour is fine, but it's sort of like a Band-Aid approach. I mean, it's helpful. It can't hurt. It's certainly helpful. But as far as, you're still going to always have two shifts during the week where you're going to still have that nine-hour period. And think about it. I mean, when you leave work, the time it takes to leave work, the time it takes to get home, the time it takes to get settled when you get home, you'll still be lucky to get 7-6 hours of sleep, if that. And don't forget, you're trying to sleep at times you don't normally sleep, like from day 4 to day 5 when you're working a day shift, getting off at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and now you got to come back to work at 10 or 11, depending on where you're at. It's not a normal thing to do. And then what about eating? When are you going to eat dinner? And, all that stuff. So it's really a tough thing to navigate, and you're just never going to get that time you need to properly sleep. But you do what you got to do. It's still indefensible if a controller falls asleep. He knows what he has to do, or she has to do, and they have to stay awake. That's just part of it.
So these incidents, the sleeping, and the guy who put his kids briefly at the controls at JFK. How do you view those incidents as evidence of a deep, broad problem, or is something else?
No, I don't consider it a problem at all. In fact, I consider it next to nothing. And the reason I say that is because you had 15,700 controllers that didn't fall asleep. And of the controllers that fell asleep, three brought their, their blankies in and their pillows, and they got fired, and they deserved to be fired. And the other four we don't know about. They didn't. It wasn't with intent that they fell asleep, and so I'm sure they're going to be looked at to decide what to do with that situation. But don't forget, every profession you consider is going to have a few people in them that either can't cut it or are going to be goofballs. I mean, look at lawyers. How many lawyers get disbarred? How many doctors suffer through malpractice? How many teachers have scandals and stuff like that? So you're always going to have a few apples in the orchard that aren't ripe and pretty good. And that's the way it is. And that's the way I look at this. The unfortunate part about the sleeping controllers was where it happened. It happened overlooking the White House. And that's some place you don't want to see something like that happen. And that's why that got so much coverage. But bottom line is, it doesn't represent the 15,700 people that stay awake every day and do their job. And by the way, do their job, no commercial fatalities in 2010, none in this year either. This is a record safety 2 years we're having right now. And I hesitate to say that because it's sort of like the ultimate little superstition controllers have about saying stuff like that, because you don't want to jinx it by over saying it. But it's the truth. Nothing's happened in 2010, nothing since 11, nothing since February 2009, the Colgan air crash. That was the last commercial incident involving fatalities.
That incident actually is a good lead-in to the last couple questions I just want to squeeze in before I let you go.
Sure.
Christine de Brabender wrote in asking you, are there airlines you won't fly because of what you've seen of their pilots or certain types of planes?
No, not so much airplanes, airlines I wouldn't fly necessarily, but there are airlines that we are aware of that have different credentials for their pilots, different standards. And what I would say to you there in that regards is, in the United States, obviously, we probably have the best pilots around. They have the most training, the best training, and the most amount of hours getting trained. A lot of times in foreign countries and foreign airlines, the training isn't the same. There's some airlines, I won't name them necessarily, where pilots become pilots because they're, friends of political or family of political tied people. So, and that's not necessarily mean they're bad pilots. It simply means that a lot of times you'll find other airlines from other countries where the captains are like 25 years old, 20 years old. I mean, it's just some ridiculous thing. But it doesn't necessarily mean they're bad pilots. It just means that they have a lot less experience than the ones that train in the United States.
So some of the regional airlines here, though, one of the stories that emerged after that that crash was the youth of the pilots, also the low pay and the fatigue. So among the regional airlines, are some of these problems that people have been talking about with air traffic controllers sort of an issue with them as well?
Well, air traffic controllers have always had issues with fatigue and stress, and it's been kind of ignored for the most part over the last 20, 30 years, and it usually takes an incident to have it come to light, and that's kind of what's been happening in the last 6 months is what you're seeing. And but this has been, people have beat this subject to death, controllers have anyway, but you have different management every 3 years, 4 years, and trying to get a history on all this with management is the tough thing to do, to understand it. And when finally we get somebody that understands it, who's a pilot, Randy Babbitt, I'm talking about here now. I mean, here's a guy that's a pilot. He understands the fatigue issues. And don't forget, fatigue issues have occurred with pilots. I mean, you go back to the two pilots who fell asleep over Minneapolis, or the two that overshot the Hawaiian Islands. I mean, this is stress and fatigue issues in aviation is a big thing. And we just need to address it more before we have more incidents. And by doing so, we'll have less incidents overall. I don't think anybody can not see that.
Great. Well, thanks, Bob. We're going to end on a lighter note, what I think is a lighter note anyway. Mark Spearman's question was really more of a statement. He said, "Sir, please give us the goods on the O'Hare UFO incident."
I can actually, and I was actually, I can do it in the first person. I was working that night, and it's funny because what happened that night was we had a really low ceiling, and it was jumping up and down from 100 feet to 500 feet, and it was a really variable ceiling. And what happened was the people that initially reported this came from the hangars up on the north end of the airport. And it actually happened right in front of us. Terminal 1's right in front of the tower. And it was kind of a neat light show for us, because every time this clouds or fog would dip up and down, and the lighting that's above United, the way it was tilted, it looked like something was moving in and out of there. And I got to tell you something. Nobody more than myself would want to see a UFO. No, nobody loves the X-Files more than I do. And the closest thing we saw to having that, I think it was in 94, we were working a midnight shift, and the brilliant light went right across the sky, right across the clouds. I mean, lit up the clouds. It was something like out of Close Encounters. Well, it turns out it was a meteorite that landed in Chicago Heights into somebody's house. And so that was the closest we've ever come to actually seeing something. Now, I have seen a few times targets on radar that we thought were kind of unusual. We've had pilots try to check them out, but nothing was confirmed. So nobody wants to see a UFO more than I do, and I could believe in stuff. But that particular incident was nothing anywhere near a UFO.
Okay. Well, what I love, Bob, is that you've brought the facts to the table today, but you've also left that little bit of mystery for all of us. So thank you.
No problem. I appreciate it, and I hope it gives people a better understanding of what controllers are all about.
That wraps up this special episode of the Work Stew podcast. Again, thanks very much to my guest, Bob Richards. Thanks also to all of the Work Stew listeners and readers who sent in questions for Bob. And thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode, episode number 9, will feature an interview with Nancy Slotnick, the founder of a company called CabLight.com and a professional dating coach. Nancy is a former headhunter who decided she was more interested in helping people manage their love lives than their careers. She has a degree from Harvard in psychological anthropology, and she has hundreds of successful marriages to her credit, only one of which is hers. I hope you'll be back to listen to that interview. In the meantime, thanks again, and bye for now.